You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Sports, a channel on the New Books Network. My name is Keith Rathbone. I'm coming to you live from Macquarie University, and I'm here today speaking with my good friend, as well as just an amazing sports historian, Heather Dichter. Heather Dichter is an associate professor of sports management and sports history at De Montfort University. And she's a member of the International Center for Sport History and Culture, and is the editor of just, a great new book, and one that I encourage everyone to pick up right away, Soccer Diplomacy, International Relations and Football Since 1914, out from University Press of Kentucky in 2020, which is itself an accomplishment this year. thank you so much for joining me, Heather.
Oh, thank you so much for having me here. And I will say, we were doing the page proofs right after, like, as the world locked down. So yes, in some ways, it does seem crazy that we, all the contributors and I, managed to get a book out in this year.
Yeah, I can't imagine some of the wrangling that must have had to happen, but we could talk about some of that, either for the recording or not. I just want to start out, I kind of know some of this, but other people don't. I was wondering, Heather, if you could tell us a bit about how you became interested in sports history, and then we can talk more about the project.
Sure, absolutely. So I think, like a lot of people, just always loved sport. And as a history major at the University of Michigan, whenever I had a chance to pick my topic for my essays, I often was drawn to some sort of sport topic within whatever class that was. And I, you know, did my undergraduate honors thesis on a sport history topic. And as I was applying to graduate school and I was kind of looking around and searching for, you know, the right programs, I realized that sport history was really a thing. And it was a field, it was developed, and it was something I could do. Really kind of went full force with that, not only being a European historian, but also being a sport historian, and really made sure that that was a central part of my master's thesis, which I did at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and then absolutely for my PhD at the University of Toronto. And, one of the reasons, there were many reasons why I wanted to go to Toronto for my PhD, but one of them was because Bruce Kidd was there, and just what a great, prominent sport historian that was somebody I could also learn from and work under was great.
So this book is not your first work on sport, obviously, but it's your most recent, and I found it fascinating because it's, for me, part of a kind of broad interest that seems to have emerged very recently in sport and diplomacy. So I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about how you developed this project, and where does it come from, and how did you get the contributors? Just talk a little bit about the project itself.
Sure. So Soccer Diplomacy largely came out of a conversation with an editor at one of the university presses. We were talking about a different project, something else. And they kind of looked at it and said, you should do something more focused, do something, a book on soccer and diplomacy. And so kind of with that idea, reached out to a number of scholars, some that I knew personally, some whose work I read and admired, others kind of did a bit of searching and found individuals for other kind of geographical areas or topics to really make this book as comprehensive about soccer as it could be. You know, obviously the presses do give you a limit on ultimately how many pages and words you get. Can't cover every country in it, but wanted to have representation or, you know, countries from all the different continents represented. And so kind of reached out to different scholars and asked if they would be interested in being part of this book. And so, you know, the response was really positive. And so it, like many edited books, took a bit longer to finally come out in print than we had all anticipated. But I was just really happy with everyone who contributed to the book. And I think what was really great was having Peter Beck write the conclusion for this book. You know, the idea of, you mentioned about sport diplomacy, you know, his 1999 book, Scoring for Britain, was really one of the first sport and diplomacy books, monographs out there. And it was on soccer, football, and Britain in the first half of the 20th century. And to have him then come back to this topic, because he hasn't really published much on that in the last years. And so for to have him come back 20 years later and write the conclusion to this book was something I was really excited about, to have him kind of talking about it all now, reflecting 20 years later, all of the work that has come out, all the work that's in this book.
Yeah, that concluding chapter, I think, is a really, I could see assigning, I could see assigning that chapter pretty broadly, just because it does such a great job of explaining some of what he was trying to do, and then also what he sees you all as doing differently from him. So I wonder if kind of moving in that direction, you could talk a little bit about, in your book, you talk about before Beck, and then even after, there was only kind of limited connection between histories of diplomacy and histories of sport. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about why you thought that was true and what you hope to do by bringing these two historiographic fields together.
Sure. Well, I think one of the challenges, and it's still a challenge a lot of us working on any type of sport and diplomacy is the access to archives, because every country has different rules as to how long, especially their national federal records, are kept closed. You know, for some countries, it might only be 25 or 30 years, and others, it's more in the 40 or 50 years. And with the use of sport within diplomacy, it does have a long history, as we show with soccer in this book, but so much of it has happened in the second half of the 20th century and more recently. And so many of those government materials are going to still be closed, or, you know, if there's a backlog in declassifying material. And so it is a bit challenging, or has been challenging in the past, to get that material, to really bring together the diplomatic documents from every country's foreign ministry, along with the relevant documents from sport organizations or individuals involved in these kinds of efforts. And so I think that's kind of been one of the reasons why the idea of sport and diplomacy as an area of academic and historical research has been a bit more recent, because obviously sport has been used in diplomacy for decades, really, you know, a solid century by now. And so it's really our access to be able to have those documents, to tell those stories, that has taken us a bit longer to get to them and to be able to publish them. But there are a lot of scholars who are working on these topics. And I think a lot of the research has come out as journal articles or book chapters. And it might be a chapter in a book that's not on sport, or is on some other elements. You know, it might be on a country, it might be on diplomacy. And so we're starting to get a greater mass of academic research and publications, but they're not always monographs. And, you know, I think some of the edited books that have come out have really helped bring a lot of different ideas together. And I hope that the books that I've edited on sport and diplomacy and others too also spurs on additional research and can really drive those larger projects that fill up an entire monograph.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, you're giving a lot of credit to Beck, but in some ways, you're kind of a leading force in thinking through some of these questions yourself. And I would say particularly well cited as well, working where you work and also being affiliated with the journals that you're affiliated with, to see this story unfold. And in the rich way that it has, in good part thanks to your work, as well as the work of other people. I would emphasize for readers, this book does kind of do a great job of covering, as Heather was saying, the geographic spread. But one of the things I found most interesting about it was actually the way in which so many of the people within it were maybe what we might call inadvertent ambassadors or kind of ugly ambassadors. So I wonder if you can talk about, when you all were putting together the project, how did you conceive of who could be a diplomat, who could engage in diplomacy?
So I actually think that, you know, we're pretty open to who was engaging in the diplomacy through soccer. I think the initial thought really was just making sure that the book had the geographical spread, you know, that it wasn't a book dominated by Europe and Latin America and like no one else. And letting each scholar themselves talk about what was, you know, who were the diplomatic actors for, you know, their own part of their area of research. And I think what came out of that just naturally was how many different, historical diplomatic actors there were, be it the athletes, be it the foreign ministries, be it the national, governing bodies for soccer, be it the continental governing bodies, or even FIFA. And so I think it just kind of naturally came about that it was just so many people being involved. And some of the actors, you know, we saw maybe coming into a few different chapters, or, you know, because they were just involved for so long, or if not necessarily an individual, but, you know, FIFA obviously shows up in quite a few places, or UEFA. So just in that sense, it there was no pushing of that or encouraging the authors from that standpoint at the first, but it just kind of naturally came about that way.
Yeah, I think I'm not trying to quiz you on it or anything, but one of the chapters I liked the most in terms of just thinking about maybe different kinds of diplomats was the chapter on Brazil that Euclides de Freitas Couto and Alan Valente wrote. It almost had the idea of Brazilianness as an ambassador itself. I thought that was really interesting.
Absolutely. And you know, and for a topic that is so recent, I mean, you know, I think when we started the book, the Brazil World Cup was the most recent World Cup, you know, and that's going to be one of those chapters. Obviously, we're not going to have the official diplomatic documents for decades still, but to still include, the work on Brazil, because it is such an important chapter and country in soccer, and this way of thinking about Brazil, Brazilianness, and how that factored into how the country was acting, or the government was acting. Absolutely. Yeah.
I have a lot of kind of more general, broad questions I want to ask about things like whether winning's an important thing in international diplomacy, and how small countries can maybe leverage these things differently. But it might be useful to kind of move through some of the chapters. And I talked to Heather beforehand, and it's unfair of me to quiz her on all the chapters, so I'm not trying to do that. But I want to point out for readers, Heather's been emphasizing it has broad geographic spread, and it really does. But there are chapters on France during the Third Republic, on sport during Francoism in Spain, on American and Icelandic football exchanges, on the 62 World Cup in Chile, Heather's work on UEFA and East German football, Australia and Vietnam. So there's a huge range of chapters. So for people who might be interested only or are primarily interested in, for example, anti-apartheid movements or apartheid movements, there's work here for you as well. But I asked Heather to think kind of about a few of the chapters and think, and we could discuss them. And one of the chapters that was particularly interesting to me was Paul Dicci's work, because it does one thing in the book that I think was important for you all, which is it stretches it into the period before the Second World War. So I wonder if you can talk to us a little bit, Heather, about where you see the origins of sports diplomacy. Where does it first emerge in modern terms, and why maybe it comes up when it does?
That's a tough one. I'm not sure I'm going to venture out on the limb and say, you know, pinpoint an actual origin. But what I think is so great, and what's about Paul Dicci's chapter and it's so important and wonderful in the book is, and in general about not just soccer diplomacy, but sport diplomacy as a whole, is that we have largely thought of this as a post-1945 concept, you know, with largely the 36 Nazi Olympics as the one big exception. And what I think is so impressive about Paul Dicci's chapter is that he shows from a democratic country before the Second World War how there was a conscious decision by the government to use soccer as part of its diplomatic efforts. And I think where this is in contrast to Peter Beck's scoring for Britain, where it was kind of like soccer was used within diplomacy for Britain in the first half of the 20th century, but not really by the Foreign Office. It wasn't like the Foreign Office set out to say, like, we are going to consciously use this. It was kind of like it happened and they were happy when it worked in their favor. But Dicci's chapter just shows and from a democratic country, consciously using soccer in these efforts to put forward the ideas of the French Third Republic and, their own diplomatic aims for the country. And so that's one of the things I think is just so impressive. You know, in contrast, when you think about the 36 Olympics, you know, those were awarded to the democratic German state, Weimar Germany, you know, and at first Hitler wasn't even interested in the games. Only later when he realized what a propaganda value would it be, then put the whole effort of the state behind it. But, you know, this is just so different with what France was doing in that interwar period. And, you know, it was a bit of a slow start. It wasn't necessarily as, gung-ho. Not everyone might, you know, didn't have all the resources behind it in the way that you'll see, or even, you know, the Brazil chapter, you know, the way that the entire Brazilian government was behind getting the World Cup in 2014. You know, it wasn't that level of resources back in the first half of the century. But just I think that's a really important part, because it's not often that we see work on sport and diplomacy before 1945 or before the Second World War, because it often wasn't seen. You know, the mantra of sport and politics being separate was still so much more widely promoted. I mean, it's still said today, but we all know that's a giant myth. And so we see less of governments really taking that direct action with respect to sport early on in the 20th century. And so I think, you know, he's done a great job of showing a country that did specifically use soccer as part of its diplomatic efforts.
I, as a French historian and as a French sports historian of that period, I really loved Dieci's chapter. I learned a lot. And I think that's one of the things that is valuable about this work is that it just illuminates kind of some of these areas of sports diplomacy that maybe haven't gotten enough attention, especially this pre-1945 period for me in this chapter in particular. But that's not everyone's interest. Heather, can you tell me a little bit more about your chapter and what you were doing in that chapter?
Sure. So my chapter focuses on a few East German football games in the first few years of the 1960s. One against or at a tournament in Portugal, and then a couple games in the Netherlands. And, you know, these were on the whole, well, one of the matches were, you know, UEFA junior tournaments. I mean, tournaments that are rarely making the news, you know, it might be a one sentence story and then a score, like not even a full on box score. And then also the qualification for the World Cup, which is a little bit more significant than the qualification for the Olympics, the 64 Olympic tournament. And, you know, showing how for East Germany in their effort to gain recognition through sport, which was, you know, a massive part of the East German government's diplomatic strategy or strategy to gain recognition at all internationally throughout the 50s and 60s through sport, and how NATO responded to that. Because, you know, again, some of these minor games, a UEFA junior tournament was something that the highest level of diplomats within all of these countries and at NATO headquarters, which at the time were still in Paris, they hadn't yet moved to Brussels, you know, and these diplomats were all talking about these tournaments and whether the East German team should be allowed to travel to Portugal and the Netherlands and the nuances of it and the public backlash of not allowing the East German team in some of these instances to be able to travel. And so really showing how, you know, it wasn't just soccer being used within diplomatic purposes or within diplomacy just as kind of a bilateral level or one country's efforts. But I mean, yes, this was East Germany's efforts, but then there was this massive response from, you know, a multi-country military organization that obviously is talking about things beyond military because they're talking about soccer tournaments.
Yeah, I have heard you talk about this before, and I really enjoyed this chapter. Why did NATO care about soccer anyway? I mean, it seems so kind of out of left field, to use a bad sports metaphor. Well,
and it wasn't just soccer. I mean, all the sports they talked about, you know, is any of East Germany's attempts to gain recognition through sport was something that NATO was trying to counter. And really, it was any and every single sport. But for them, it was because of the agreement that NATO made when the Federal Republic joined the organization and saying that they would not recognize the communist German state because that was the West German or the Federal Republic of Germany's policy. It was called the Hallstein Doctrine of not recognizing this other German state, you know, claiming it was illegitimate, didn't have a democratically elected government. And so, you know, protecting the West, protecting their NATO member of the Federal Republic of Germany meant countering these efforts by East Germany. And it was a sense that the security of the West could ultimately be threatened by this other German state or, you know, the communist bloc as a whole. And so they really did consider all sorts of issues, which, you know, are so far removed from the military, you know, but they ultimately kind of came back and mattered. the entity within NATO that was always discussing sport was the Political Advisors Committee. And so it wasn't the, you know, it wasn't each country's military delegate or, you know, highest military representative, but their political representative who was. And because all of those issues did still, you know, politics and diplomacy and the military do have to work with each other. They go not necessarily hand in hand, but they work closely with each other. And so all of those political advisors, you know, report back to their foreign ministry in, you know, their capital city and in their countries. And so it very much was this concept, this idea that NATO talked about actually quite frequently throughout the late 50s and especially the 1960s.
And of course, all the NATO members totally agreed with this policy, right?
It was definitely one of the more contested ones, particularly when it was going to be a country that was hosting. You know, they kept trying to put this national interest category for some of them, definitely for the soccer games, you know, for the Netherlands, for Portugal. You know, soccer is a huge sport in these countries, and they are going to want to have their tournaments run well. They want to have everyone there. You know, they want to be the focus of attention. For other countries, you know, for Norway, it was the skiing events, and especially the ski jumping events, you know, claiming national interest for that. And I do sometimes wonder when I read these documents, you know, the each country's political advisors committee, their reports back, you know, their long telegrams and letters back to their foreign ministries. I do sometimes wonder how much eye rolling there initially was during some of these meetings, because I think sometimes with some of these arguments, you just wonder, like, I bet they must have been, you know, and yet it was also this frustration of if a country did have its event disrupted because East Germany wasn't going to be allowed to participate, and especially if the rest of the communist bloc withdrew their teams as well. You know, this idea of disrupting the West, which is how the communist bloc really saw these actions, these collective actions. You know, and then it became a matter of bad, you know, it was bad PR. It looked bad on the host country and really its government and its foreign policies. And so there was a sense of like, well, we don't want this to happen to us. We want to be the exception. But then the countries who it did happen to, you know, and did have their events disrupted, were the ones who then were like, okay, you all, the rest of the NATO better also maintain this policy. You know, you shouldn't get some exception that I didn't get. And so there really had to be this balance. And yeah, they did talk about sport way more than you would think they would have.
Yeah, I mean, like I say, I've heard you talk about this before, but rereading this chapter, I think, was really illuminating, and I think it helps to show the ways in which sports can help shape and reshape NATO and the important role that smaller countries were playing in these discussions. A lot of the chapters in this book have to do with small countries. It was that a kind of aim of the project?
You know, I think as the book started to take shape, it became an element that was actually really exciting, and I think important for thinking about sport diplomacy and especially soccer diplomacy. You know, that it's not just France, England, Spain, Brazil, Argentina. You know, the countries you think of as your big soccer powerhouses, but that, you know, sport is used by so many countries around the world, and especially soccer, because it is the most popular sport in the world. And, you know, the desire to try to get to the World Cup, and if a country can finally get there, or the, you know, even through the qualification process of getting to the World Cup, it's so important in so many countries. And to have that come out in quite a few of these chapters, and having chapters on countries that we don't normally think of with soccer, because there's other codes of football that are more popular in those countries. You know, I think the U.S. and Australia are probably the two biggest ones on that front, maybe even a bit with South Africa. But then also smaller countries, you know, Trinidad and Tobago. And, you know, when we started this book, Iceland hadn't had its great Euro run. And so then that became really exciting that Iceland was in this book. So it made it seem even more timely. But I think, you know, the fact that so many countries have used soccer and had soccer be part of its diplomatic efforts is one of the big important points that's come out of the book and as it was taking shape, and wanted to be an aspect that I wanted to highlight, you know, and also Sarah Snyder in her chapter and Peter Beck in his conclusion, kind of also emphasizing that point as well, you know, just how broadly soccer is used and is part of diplomatic efforts and diplomacy.
Yeah, Heather is alluding to a couple chapters here that both of which I thought were particularly interesting. George Cusis's chapter on American and Iceland football exchange, a U.S.-Icelandic friendly, a home in a way friendly in 1955-1956. And one of the things that's interesting about that particular exchange is how bad the American team is. The American team loses seemingly all of their games. and the Icelandic press is very generous and not ridiculing them too much. Is it important in sports diplomacy for teams to win? Or because oftentimes I think that's a part of our stories when we're writing sports histories is the outcomes of games actually matter. And it's important that games are kind of, we don't know what the outcome might be ahead of time. So there's this sense of real contingency, but a lot of times your story was different here. So I'm wondering if you can talk about winning and losing in diplomacy.
Yeah, no. And I think that's an element that I guess we don't really think about as a concept, that it kind of sometimes is, you know, this country wins, and it, especially during the Cold War, it's the triumph of one side over the other, democracy over communism or communism over democracy. And so I think in those kind of direct competition between countries who are competing in general, and I think that's when the idea of the outcome matters. But, you know, in this case, between Iceland and the U.S., you know, the U.S. had a clear result that they wanted, which was the ability to maintain that airbase in Iceland. You know, so I think in that sense, you know, maybe losing isn't the worst thing, you know, and makes Iceland feel better so that they're more willing to maintain this, you know, agreement with the United States to use the airbase and within Iceland. But I also think what's so fascinating is in George's chapter is like the real disparity between the interest and approach, because, you know, the U.S. doesn't bring, you know, a national team, you know, who the Icelandic team plays against when they come to the U.S. is really an assortment of random teams in many respects. You know, it's not an even treatment of what these visits mean to each other. And I think that kind of sense of uneven diplomacy or uneven treatment within diplomacy is fascinating.
The other chapter you were alluding to a little bit is Eric Nielsen's chapter. I won't name it because I try not to use one of the words that he uses in the chapter, not being an Australian. But it's a chapter about the Socceroos' first kind of international triumph in 1967 in South Vietnam, in the midst of the Vietnam War. For Australian listeners, this is a particularly interesting work. And one of the things that I think Eric tries to show is just how important non-state actors were. And so I wonder, you know, if we can circle back a little bit to that and thinking about that throughout the whole project, you know, how in the story of this soccer diplomacy, how important were kind of national federations and their goals? So in other words, how much of this diplomatic effort is kind of incidental to the efforts of organizations?
You know, I think it'll depend within each context, and, you know, not even just each country, but, you know, sometimes it'll be one instance versus another. But I think the national governing bodies really do play a strong role, especially because they are the ones, when it comes to the national team, that have that oversight for it. So governments do increasingly engage with the national governing bodies, liaise with them, you know, make sure that they know what's expected of them while they're going to another country, particularly if it is a country the two countries have fraught relations with, or, you know, something along those lines. And yeah, Eric's chapter is fascinating. I mean, Australia sent its national team to Vietnam in the middle of the war. And that's just shocking in and of itself, you know, and he talks about the challenges of what documents are available and memory because of, you know, Johnny Warren's memoirs. And that is much in the way that Australia remembers this tournament, is through his own, through Warren's book. But the sense of, you know, was this really something that, I mean, the Australian government really wanted? Was this something more that just the Australian Soccer Federation wanted, because Australia hadn't really done much thus far, you know, this real venture into international soccer? And so yeah, it becomes these difficult and this interplay between the different groups and entities, be it the national governing bodies or the foreign ministries, and who's kind of playing the dominant role in one instance versus another.
I did love the way in which memory and evidence were central in this chapter. And I'll have to ask Eric about, it's funny because Eric also works at Macquarie, but I haven't talked to him about this chapter. So I'll have to talk to him about that. But one of the other things I really liked about this chapter is, as you point out, you know, what we know about it, we get a lot of that information from one person who wrote a memoir about the experience, And it made me think about how states transform individual athletes then into these inadvertent diplomats. And I wondered if you thought throughout the book, or maybe for in your own work, to what extent athletes are acting as kind of political agents. I think that's a question we often ask ourselves, is whether they're kind of co-opted or how much they know.
Yeah. And there's a lot of academics who have written on different athletes. You know, I think perhaps one of the largest groups that have had, or one of the groups that's had the largest amount of academic, you know, historical research kind of done with respect to that, is on the State Department's use of African-American athletes during the Cold War, and especially to African countries. In that sense of saying, you know, look, no, you know, race relations aren't so bad in the U.S., and trying to minimize that by sending the great African-American athletes overseas. And so I think it is an instance where some athletes might be more willing and believing within the diplomatic and political goals of their country. Others might be more young or more naive. And so, you know, I think it's hard to say an overarching answer on that one way or another. And I think, again, it's one of those where each instance, you know, needs to be evaluated on its own. But, you know, going back to that sense of memory, or, you know, what we know based on what one athlete says, you know, and Eric talks about the challenges and the fact that, you know, those files relating to that trip are not available within the Australian archives, you know, that people are not allowed to see them, where they no longer exist, you know, and that's a challenge then, because how can we really truly figure everything out when we don't have all parts of the story? You know, having the athlete's side, having the national governing body side, having the foreign ministry side, having the press, you know, putting all of those together is how we really get the full story, or the different parts of the story that may still always be a little bit different from each other. But you get a greater understanding from having the multitude of sources. And when one side is, and one element of those is completely missing, you know, and a different side is what is quite prominent, you know, with something like the memoir from the team captain and a prominent athlete, that can kind of skew what the majority of people understand about an issue, you know, and that's where I guess our work as historians is really important, to really bring in all the sides for that greater understanding.
Yeah, I in reading the book, and I definitely was curious, and I'm learning from you about the process a little bit of how it was all put together. But there's a lot in this book that is kind of unexpected. It takes a story we've heard in another way and reflects it through new light. In particular, I'm thinking of the chapter about apartheid sport, which takes the perspective of the failures of the apartheid government to use sports diplomacy more effectively. And often we hear the other side of that story. So I was wondering, you know, what are some, are there particular ways in which, when you were putting the book together, particular holes or particular things that you thought sport diplomacy, soccer diplomacy more particularly, could change the stories that we've been told about sports history, or just about, I mean, history more generally?
I guess, yeah, you know, I do hope that this book and the variety of topics and countries included in it does make people think differently, or think more about the use of sport, and particularly soccer, within diplomacy and as diplomacy. But absolutely, I think, you know, Chris Bolzman's chapter on South Africa, this concept of failed sport diplomacy, was great. You know, it's in many ways kind of this whole different idea, this idea of, you know, we often talk about sport diplomacy and soccer diplomacy as being, you know, used to achieve a specific aim. And we often talk about when that happens. And here's, you know, it doesn't work in this instance. And so, you know, it would be great if more people can also, you know, more scholars can look at other instances of failed sports diplomacy. And I think just kind of, you know, the initial goal of getting chapters was to ensure the geographic spread. You know, I guess that's kind of the blunt way of looking at it. And I was pretty open to what the chapters would talk about. But as they all came in and reading them all, you know, the great part was, even though they were all written by different scholars who were just writing their own chapter, the number of themes or ideas that arose in so many different ones. And while most chapters didn't actually talk about, you know, the actual financial side of things, you know, in many ways that is what pushes some of the decisions that are being made or the actions that are being taken, especially when it comes to hosting a sporting event. You know, it's the PR that comes with it, you know, and that's why governments support their national governing bodies to, you know, want to host these kind of events, be it the World Cup, be it a UEFA tournament, be it a continental tournament. But the money kind of drives some of those ideas as well and underlying it. And so that was kind of one of those fascinating elements that came out of just seeing all the chapters together.
Yeah, I've recently had the opportunity to read a number of edited volumes, kind of cover to cover, which is something we don't always do enough of, and I was just astounded by the diversity and just the high quality I don't mean to disparage our colleagues, but sometimes you read edited volumes and you're like, oh, they're the two duds in the book. This does not have any duds. I will say each chapter was fascinating in its own right. And I wish we had a lot of time to talk about all of the different ones, especially there's a few that are just interesting kind of on their own, especially the chapter on a certain Trinidad and Tobago FIFA member.
And, you know, and I have to say with that chapter, that was one where, you know, he keeps coming into the, Jack Warner keeps coming into the news. And I kept thinking like, oh my God, do you need to rewrite your chapter? Like, we've just done page proofs. There's now, you know, his court cases again, like what is going on? And, you know, I guess that's one of the challenges that many of us never think about with history is we're writing about things that happened so long ago. But then when you do either, you know, I remember once with a journal article, you know, and I had actually talked about Sepp Blatter being reelected, you know, in this article about corruption. And then between when I submitted it to the journal and when it, you know, got the decision, it was like he now wasn't president. And, you know, I was like, oh my gosh, I have to rewrite the entire intro. And I was a bit concerned on that with a little bit with the Trinidad and Tobago chapter. You know, every point it was like, do you need to update things? Like, is it still accurate now? So yeah.
I have to admit, I was reading that chapter and I'm just reading aloud to my wife, like, can you believe this is going on? you know so many of the details, but then you read them in one place again and written so well, you're like, oh, this is, some of this is just a little shocking.
I know, yeah.
Now, I could go on and on, and I will say, you know, like I said, I think every chapter in this particular volume is really a worthwhile contribution and really interesting in its own right. And I thank you for putting it all together, Heather. I know the kind of work that goes into this enterprise. So I guess my last question for you is the last question I ask people generally. And you can tell me if during COVID time, this is an unfair question, but what do we have to look forward to next? What are you currently working on that we'll be reading when it's out?
Sure. So I was able, even during a pandemic, I have recently finished editing my monograph. So if you especially liked my chapter, I have an entire book on all of the NATO's dealings with the German question or the German problem in the 1960s, and especially as it pertained and intertwined with the entire bidding for the 1968 Olympics, both the summer and winter bids, because obviously the games happened in 68, but the bids were in the beginning of the decade, which was, you know, really the height of the problems in the Cold War with Germany, you know, right after the Berlin Wall went up. So that I have, where I talk about not only soccer, but truly every single sport that came to be an issue with respect to the East German athletes and the NATO states. So that book, I hope, should be out in late 2021 with the University of Massachusetts Press. And in the meantime, I have been working with Sarah Tietzel from the University of Manitoba on two special issues of the International Journal for the History of Sport on the Olympic Winter Games. And I will be having a article on Calgary's failed 68 bid, which for the 68 Winter Games, kind of one of those articles that comes out of just the massive amount of accumulation of documents for a monograph. And then obviously not all of them will ever be used in the book, and being able to write some additional pieces from some of that research. So I'm really excited on these two special issues on the Olympic Winter Games, because once again, you know, drawing on a number of really great scholars working on a variety of topics and countries. And I guess I just really enjoy those opportunities of reading and bringing together different people's work. It is a lot of work editing different projects, but I guess I'm just always really happy with the final product.
Well, I'm looking forward to both of these, both your book and the edited article collections. I'm anticipating that you're going to be dishing hard on Canada in both venues.
You know, Canada has an interesting role in my monograph. The article and the Winter Olympics will just actually focus on some of the internal Canadian efforts supporting Calgary's bid. So I think that one will be a different focus when it comes to Canada.
Well, I'm glad, and I'm glad to hear it, and I'm really looking forward to them, and I'll be anxious to see them both in print. Thank you very much for joining us, Heather.
Thank you for having me. It's been wonderful speaking with you today, Keith.
You've all been listening to New Books in Sports, a channel on the New Books Network. My name is Keith Rathbone. I've been speaking today with Heather Dichter. Heather is an associate professor of sport history and sport management at De Montfort University and a member of the International Center for Sports History and Culture at De Montfort University. And I'm Keith Rathbone, coming to you live from Macquarie University. Thank you all very much for listening.